This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. In a moment, we'll hear from the South Korean capital, which has again seen large protests by supporters and opponents of the beleaguered president. Also, what medical facilities are still functioning in Gaza after more than a year of war between Hamas and Israel. And later, an award-winning record producer revisits a prison in Mississippi where he previously recorded an album of the songs of the inmates.
Jesus, we'll never, never say no.
I've returned to Parchman Prison because there had been such a strong positive response to their debut record. The administration has made great improvements there at the prison. The men were very proud of their success, and we were granted more time together this time, and many of them had prepared original songs.
And that report in full in about 15 minutes. The South Korean capital, Seoul, was bitterly cold last night with heavy snow, and it's not much warmer today. But that hasn't stopped tens of thousands of protesters gathering on the streets of the city to show their support and opposition to President Yoon Suk-yeol. He's currently suspended after being impeached for his botched attempt to declare martial law last month. Mr. Yoon has taken refuge in his official residence, and his security detail, numbering in the hundreds on Friday, thwarted an attempt by investigators to detain the president for alleged insurrection. They're expected to try again before the expiry of the arrest warrant on Monday, but the president's security detail say they will again resist. Tensions boiled over when anti-Yoon protesters broke through police barricades to occupy a road leading to the presidential residence. Supporters, or rather protesters supporting the president, explained why they were there.
There was no deep affection for President Yoon Suk-yeol during the last presidential election. But this time, after the president took office and implemented policies which led to his diplomatic achievements and his absolute anti-communist ideology regarding national security, as our country is a divided nation, our people came out to give their full support to the president.
Well, this anti-Yoon protester was one of thousands taking to the streets, defying the extremely cold weather and snow.
Even when it snows, the president is holding out inside the official residence. I live nearby. And even when it snows or when the weather's cold, we need to keep coming here to protest. So a place like this, where many people gather, will be less cold, right? So I'll keep coming out to rally until the president is gone.
Well, a short while ago, BBC Korean reporter Woongbi Lee in Seoul gave me an update.
Mass crowd is still in front of the president's office, both the opponents and also those who are rooting for the president. It's been very cold, snowing in South Korea. Despite that, the crowds are still, especially the supporters of the president, is not retreating from the scene, thinking the investigators may come any time before the warrant expiry time, which is tomorrow.
And the protesters, how close have they been able to get to the president's official residence?
The protesters are outside of the residence, probably 200 meters away from the entrance. So there are both supporters of the president, and then a block away from that, there's also the protesters who are seeking and claiming that the president should be arrested right away. And the police is in the middle, making sure there's no clash or physical violent situation happening.
And how would you describe the mood?
It's still very tense atmosphere in front of the president's office. However, after the initial attempt of arrest failed, it seems there's less concern of the immediate clash or violence. It's more on standby. However, the tense mood is still on the ground with multiple police buses nearby standby for any incident.
So for the moment, the police have been able to keep apart those who support and oppose the president.
Yes, the police is keeping apart the opposing groups and supporters of the president. Fortunately, there has not been any physical incident reported apart from some language exchanges, and the president and the authorities are keeping their eyes on on-site safety as it's right in the middle of Seoul.
So how is this expected to end? I mean, you've mentioned that time is running out for the exercise of the arrest warrant. I mean, if the president survives that, what then?
After the current warrant expires tomorrow, what the COI could do is they could apply for another warrant, which would also have 1 week of valid time. However, unless things change, that warrant realistically doesn't seem to have much effect. Alternatively, what others, the ruling party, is saying is that because the president has said he's willing to go on court and go through legit process of hearing. So some are saying actually that may be an easier path, which may take longer than immediate arrest. Basically, there's two different buckets. One is on the legitimacy of the president declaring martial law. Then there's another bucket of the investigators going through his impeachment process. What the president vowed to comply with is going through the procedure and hearing for the impeachment decision. However, that takes up to 180 days. So the public, who was angry for the president's declaration of martial law, is rather requesting immediate arrest for investigation on his martial law charge.
That was Wong Bi Lee, BBC Korean reporter, speaking to me from Seoul. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says 88 people have been killed in the past 24 hours in Israeli attacks, bringing the overall death toll to nearly 46,000 in 15 months of war. Israel began bombarding Gaza after Hamas, deemed a terrorist group by many Western governments, led an attack on Israel in October 2023, which left more than 1,200 people dead. Hamas also says that more than 100,000 people have been injured in Gaza since the war broke out, but the damage to and destruction of hospitals and health facilities in the territory mean that increasingly there's nowhere left to treat them. Dr. Rick Peppercorn is World Health Organization representative for the West Bank and Gaza. He's currently in Amsterdam and joins us now. Are there any hospitals still functioning in Gaza, and in particular in the north of the territory?
Yeah, thanks for having me. When you look at the hospital functionality currently, and visiting Gaza very regularly myself, and me, my teams, I've been to all these hospitals, and in the last couple of months, I've been four or five times also to the hospitals in the north, Kamalat 1 and Al-Ada, multiple times. So the total out of the 36 hospitals, we qualify as WHO, 16 to be functional. In the north, when you talk, we talk only about one hospital in the north, that's Al-Ada, which is, we qualify as absolutely minimal functional. There's no primary healthcare centers left and no medical points in the north.
I mean, we know that the Kamal Adwan Hospital was recently taken over by the Israeli military and that its director is now thought to be in custody. But what of the Indonesian hospital also in the north?
Well, I think it's good to say something about Kamal Adwan, because indeed that was the main hospital in the north of Gaza and put out of service following a raid last week on the 27th December, and I would say also relentless attacks since October this year. We know from visits, etc., that some areas of the hospitals were burned, severely damaged, etc., during the raid, the lab, the surgical unit, engineering, maintenance departments, etc. We have been assessed so often, but we were also not always facilitated in accessing the hospital with supplies, medical supplies, blood, EMT, during the periods I'm talking about. Out of the 21 missions of WHO, only 10 were facilitated. Now, I think we are deeply concerned about Dr. Usama Abu Safia, the director of Kamalat 1, was detained during the raid, and we lost contact with him. And we call for his immediate release. Now, on Indonesian hospital, situation continues to deteriorate. It's a non-functional hospital. It has currently 7 patients, 9 caregivers, and 6 health workers remain there. And we spoke with the director yesterday, and they're requesting us, WHO, to support ready-to-eat food and clothes, as many of those patients and companions who left Kamalat 1 are without anything.
Okay. Can the WHO get any medical equipment into Gaza to those hospitals that are still functioning in whole or in part?
Yeah, I think I just want to also make that point. Like, for we are also planning, WHO, a mission to Alada Kamalat 1 in Indonesia in the coming day for an assessment and support. Roads are horrible at the moment, and so we urge for access and to be facilitated as quickly as possible. I want to say something that sounds a little odd. Also say something a little positive. As I said, 16 of the 36 hospitals are still partly functional. There used to be more than 5,000 hospital beds. We currently talk about 1,500. But a lot of the hospitals, I mean, we've been in the news, if you talk about Shifa Hospital, Nasser Medical Complex, European Gaza Hospital, Al-Akhli, all of them, they have been became non-functional ones, severely damaged, etc., non-functional, and they are partly functional again, with massive support of WHO and partners, supplies, etc., and the incredible resilience of their health workers.
Okay. I just want to ask you finally, and I want a brief answer, if I may, from you. Do you have any figures for the number of Palestinians who have died through a lack of medical treatment?
That's, I think, a really good question. There was, an analysis done in the Lancet, I think, already months ago, and that run into the thousands. We have to do all those assessment studies, because you mentioned the figure of 110,000 injuries, for example. Well, based on our assessment of this 110,000 injuries, more than a quarter, so close to 25 to 30,000 of them, they have injuries which need lifelong medical technology and assistance.
Dr. Peppercorn, I'm afraid I've got to end it there. We're out of time. Dr. Rick Peppercorn, World Health Organization representative for the West Bank and Gaza. Coming up, New York City prepares to finally introduce a charge to drive your car into Manhattan. But why has it taken so long?
It's American car culture, I think. And there's a real tension of, charging people to drive places. You know, it's below Central Park. There's now going to be a charge to go over the iconic Brooklyn Bridge, which was always free. There's going to be a charge to go over the iconic Manhattan Bridge, which was always free. So this is a big cultural change, as well as a new tax.
And the top stories from the BBC newsroom. Ukrainian forces have launched a new offensive to seize more territory in Russia's Kursk region. And guards protecting President Yoon of South Korea say they'll continue to resist a warrant for his arrest in connection with his short-lived declaration of martial law. It's been 11 seasons since Manchester United last lifted the English Premier League trophy under the management of Sir Alex Ferguson. Gradually, the Red Devils have transitioned from being the club that dominated English football every year to the team that wanders through the league season after season, hoping for a chance to qualify for some European competition in the following campaign. The appointment of new manager Ruben Amorim was intended to be the solution the club needed to reverse its current predicament. But after the first month under the Portuguese coach, Manchester United are still languishing at 14th in the Premiership table as they prepare for their game against league leaders Liverpool later today. And Mr. Amorim now says Manchester United could be dragged into a fight against relegation if they don't start winning soon. Mark Obden is a senior football writer for ESPN and, in fact, a Manchester United fan himself. So, what's gone wrong?
How long have you got? This basically goes back to 2013 when Sir Alex Ferguson retired as manager. 27 years, he won 13 Premier League titles. United were the biggest and the best. Also, at the same time, the chief executive, David Gill, retired or stepped down. And it just left a massive void, a vacuum, which they filled with people that weren't anywhere close to being as good as they were at the job. Bad appointments, wasteful spending on players, being too faithful to people that weren't succeeding in executive levels, to the point now where 10, 11 years later, United have been set adrift of the big clubs by some distance. They've basically taken their eye off the ball, and the Glazer family who owned the club sold a third of the stake in the club to Ineos, led by Sir Jim Ratcliffe, about a year ago. Britain's one of Britain's richest men. But it hasn't really changed anything. United are still in a state of chaos, basically, because they haven't been able to overcome the hangover of Sir Alex Ferguson's retirement.
That was a long time ago, wasn't it? Sir Alex standing down. Enough time, surely, to regain some of the confidence that made them such a major club.
Absolutely. You know, you look at all the other major clubs in Europe and they've all had dips in form over the last 10, 12 years, but they've managed to emerge from them fairly quickly. But I think United's problem is that for too long, and I think they've only just recently come away from this, for too long they would ask themselves the question, what would Sir Alex do? In a modern game that had changed, a data-driven game, United were still trying to make the successful methods of the 1990s and early 2000s work in the modern day. They hadn't appointed a sporting director until a year ago now. In the modern game, a sporting director is crucial. He identifies the players, he identifies the coach, he oversees the structure of the football side of the club. United allowed Ferguson to do that for 27 years, so when he left, it left a black hole. And
who are these people who are making all, in your view, the wrong appointments?
Well, it's right to the top that it's the Glazer family. The Glazers bought the club in 2005, a controversial purchase. They put United, who were at that time the most profitable, best-run club in the world, they put them into debt to the extent of over £500 million. And ever since then, the club have been servicing that debt. So the Glazers, in many ways, used Man United as a cash machine. The people they appointed in executive positions were basically hired to keep the club successful commercially rather than from a football sense and the football piece.
And we now have a situation where the newly appointed coach, Ruben Amorim, says that Manchester United could be dragged into a fight against relegation if they don't start winning soon. I mean, that sounds pretty desperate.
Well, that's right. I mean, going into Sunday's game against Liverpool at Anfield, they had lost five of the last six Premier League games. They're in the bottom half of the table. It's the worst season they've had in the Premier League since the Premier League began in 1992. I don't personally think United will be dragged into relegation, but I do think it's wise of the coach to say, you might be the biggest club in the world or one of the biggest clubs in the world, but if you don't perform on the pitch, you may be relegated. Man United were last relegated in 1974. Totally different era, different times. For many years, Man United's failure would have been finishing third in the Premier League. They would finish first or second. Now they're talking about finishing in the bottom three, which beggars belief, really. But that shows you how far the club has declined. It's going to be a long way back.
That was Mark Ogden, a senior football writer for ESPN, speaking here on BBC NewsHour.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
You're with NewsHour. And after many twists and turns, New York has finally introduced charges on vehicles entering the city, what are known as congestion charges. It's the first scheme of its kind in the United States and is aimed at reducing traffic congestion, improving air quality, and generating money for improvements to public transport. London and several other cities across the world already have similar schemes. My colleague Paul Henley spoke to Jeff Colton, New York City reporter with Politico and co-author of the New York Playbook.
It's charging about $9 USD during most of the day. Overnight, it's going to be $2.25. And this has been a long time coming. This has been a controversial plan that was introduced about 20 years ago, about the same time that the London congestion pricing was implemented. But it's never happened in New York. We've been talking about it for decades. And after long political battle, long legal battles, it's finally about to go into effect.
Why has it been so contentious when it hasn't elsewhere? I mean, outside America.
It's American car culture, I think. And there's a real tension of, you know, charging people to drive places. Now, at the same time, there's already tolls to enter a lot of Manhattan. If you're coming in from a lot of the tunnels into New York City, into Manhattan, you're already getting charged. But this is still a new charge for a lot of entrances into Manhattan. You know, it's below Central Park. There's now going to be a charge to go over the iconic Brooklyn Bridge, which was always free. There's going to be a charge to go over the iconic Manhattan Bridge, which was always free. So this is a big cultural change, as well as a new tax. That said, it's going to fund the New York City subways, the largest and most iconic subway system in certainly in North America and arguably in the world.
So presumably public transport bosses have been on side. Who else has, and who's been anti?
There has been a quite an angry contingent here, you know, primarily among the people that do drive into Manhattan daily for work. Now, the supporters of congestion pricing will say, look, you know, I'm sorry, but that's a small minority. You know, the vast, vast majority of people that are coming into Manhattan are coming in by public transport. They're coming in by the subways. They're coming in by the buses. There's only a small percentage that actually comes in driving their cars. And so, yes, this is a pain for them. They are now going to be charged more. But really, the goal here is to change their behavior, and the goal is to get them into trains.
Could local Republicans appeal to Donald Trump this year to intervene?
Yes. So the reason it is going into effect right now is to beat Donald Trump into office. Trump himself has very much opposed congestion pricing. He sees it as a political issue. He sees it as something that he can, you know, gain support from drivers and, you know, from those opposed to the Democratic Party that leads New York. And so Trump has said he will stop congestion pricing. And the reason that the New York government has pushed ahead and putting this into effect just merely 3 weeks before Donald Trump is going into office is, as you know, they're hoping that once it's into effect, Trump is not going to be able to repeal it.
That was journalist Jeff Colton. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. Nicolas Maduro is scheduled to be sworn in as Venezuela's president next Friday, but Edmundo González continues to insist the job is his. The Venezuelan opposition leader says he won last year's presidential election, and his victory has been recognized by the United States and the European Parliament. And Mr. González, who fled Venezuela last September to avoid arrest, is currently on a tour of the region seeking the backing of leaders there. His latest stop is Uruguay, where he addressed a rally of his Venezuelan supporters in Montevideo and vowed to continue his fight to return to Venezuela.
The government may close the airspace, may close the highways, may close the entrances to Caracas, but it will not prevent the resounding victory that we have already obtained.
Well, I'm joined in the studio by the BBC's Latin America reporter, Mimi Swaby. Where else has he been apart from Uruguay? Where else is he going?
Edmundo González, the opposition leader, started his road to freedom, his international tour, seeking and strengthening his support in Argentina, where he was met really warmly by President Javier Milei, Argentina's president, went onto the balcony of Casa Rosada, the presidential palace, and was greeted by the fans chanting, freedom, freedom. Javier Milei has said that he would not Argentina would not be complicit in what he has called the injustices of Maduro's regime. He's been an ally from the start when Edmundo González supposedly lost the elections back in July. He also stressed the need for a regional collaboration to build a prosperous Latin America, free from any type of government, what he called, of dubious democratic quality. So he's really come forward and say this is a big return for González to Latin America after being in Madrid in exile since September. And he's come forward and said, we will welcome you with open arms, but also we're going to build this as a foundation for what Latin America can be.
Although very symbolic, this Mimi, we don't expect this to translate into any coordinated invasion of Venezuela by other countries in the region.
No, it is very symbolic, and there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of discourse since the presidential elections, the disputed elections back in July of last year. Many in Latin America and the wider region have accepted and formally put forward that Edmundo González is the rightful president of Venezuela. Only a few countries have said that Maduro, who declared victory, is the actual president. Countries like Russia and Nicaragua. However, he still has many more trips on many more positions to go to. He's got Panama, he's got Dominican Republic, and now the US as well. We're not sure when his meeting with President Joe Biden will be, but Edmundo González has said he will also be stopping in the US before he pledges to return to Caracas and take his rightful position, as he calls it.
Mimi, many thanks. That's the BBC's Latin America reporter, Mimi Swaby. So will Mr. Maduro be concerned that Edmundo González is touring the region, trying to drum up support? I've been speaking to Christopher Sabatini, who's senior fellow at the Chatham House think tank here in London, where he specialises in Latin America.
I think he's concerned more generally about what will happen on January 10th. He won in a largely discredited election by most official tallies, and even supported largely by the United Nations and the Carter Center that were there on election day. Edmundo González won over 60% of the vote, although the Maduro government is denying that and showing no evidence to suggest otherwise. So he's clearly didn't win the popular vote. There were waves of protest after the elections on July 28th. And now he's heading into an inauguration that I think many people will see as illegitimate. And so he's clearly hitting a few of the capitals in Latin America, and he'll actually be going to the United States later in the week, probably meeting with President Biden and President-elect Trump in an effort to instill the sense that he's the legitimate president and Maduro is not.
But Mr. Maduro has form on this one, his ability to sit out these threats to his leadership and indeed contested elections.
He's certainly a survivor, and he could possibly survive this. This, however, is a little different. The past efforts have largely stemmed around failed efforts to boycott elections by the opposition, an effort to declare an interim shadow president in 2019 who hadn't been elected as president. This is a little different because the international community has been watching. The UN has denounced the election. I think there's a little more international momentum and there's a little more popular legitimacy around the opposition in this case. But yes, he's a survivor. He's willing to pull out all the stops in the security and in the economy and the state apparatus to make sure that he stays in power. But as of January 10th, he'll have 6 years in power. And that's a long time, given the state of the economy and given the state of popular opinion against him.
Mr. González himself, you talk about 60% of the vote in those elections. Does that reflect the kind of support that he has in the country?
It isn't so much popular support for Edmundo González. He is a retired diplomat, elderly, 75 years old, and he really had never been much of a public figure before. He was a stand-in for a very popular candidate, Maria Corina Machado, who is prohibited from basically ever holding public office by the Supreme Court, which is packed with Maduro supporters. So it's really not so much his popularity. She's really the driver of this. And he was sort of, if you will, a figurehead of popular, basically frustration, even anger, with President Maduro, who, again, has driven the economy into it. At one point, it had contracted by three quarters. There's clearly economic desperation and political frustration there. And Edmundo González has become, if you will, sort of the figurehead of that.
So if Ms. Machado was making this tour of regional countries, you suggest that she might be whipping up a lot more support?
She's really a very inspiring speaker, very good on the hustings. I think she would be, but unfortunately she's in the country in hiding right now. The government has said it will arrest her, so no one knows where she is in the country. She refuses to leave. So it's really Edmundo Gonzalez who's the stand-in for now. But the man did courageously endure an election in which basically the government was throwing everything they could at it to make sure the opposition lost and even had difficulty organizing and holding rallies. So he's really the figurehead right now, and you know, he's doing a good job. Buenos Aires, Panama, and a few other countries then probably head to Washington. So right now he's the only international stand-in they have, because Maria Corina Machado really can't leave the country.
And do you think Mr. Gonzalez will try to return to Venezuela, where, of course, there is a $100,000 bounty on his head?
First of all, that's a pittance for a bounty, quite frankly. It's a reflection of Venezuela's collapsed economic state. But I don't think he will return to Venezuela. He's been saying he will. But the truth is he's already fled under the threat of arrest for sedition. And he is elderly. So I don't think he'll return. What he's trying to do more than anything is trying to instill a certain amount of fear on the part of the Maduro government. The people will react, a certain amount of uncertainty of what will happen before or after January 10th. But no, it would be foolhardy for him to leave, in part because it would remove having this roving ambassador, which he's serving as right now, for the opposition and the stolen election of January 28th.
That was Christopher Sabatini, who's a senior fellow at the Chatham House think tank here in London, where he specialises in Latin America. The family of an American schoolteacher who's been serving a 14-year sentence inside a Russian labour camp is hoping a new US government designation will finally pave the way for his return. Mark Fogel is now classified as wrongfully detained. The 61-year-old was arrested in the autumn of 2021 and later convicted on charges of large-scale drug smuggling. He was convicted by the same court that sent American basketball player Brittany Griner to prison, but she was returned home after the US State Department negotiated a prison swap in 2022. Mark Fogel taught at the American School of Moscow. He was arrested on his way back for the start of the new school year with under 20 grams of marijuana and a doctor's prescription for a medical condition. NewsHour's Paul Henley spoke to Anne Fogel, Mark's sister. So why had it taken so long for Mark to be officially declared wrongfully detained?
It's hard to know. There are a number of things that have happened. You know, besides the fact of, you know, we're in our fourth year. There has been no movement. I mean, whether they thought that the president of Russia would release him on humanitarian grounds, I think that they asked repeatedly for Mark's release on humanitarian grounds, even though they've never released anyone on humanitarian grounds. I really can't answer that question. It's a question for the State Department.
In any case, large-scale drug smuggling was always pretty ridiculous, wasn't it?
Oh, it was incredibly ridiculous. You know, Mark took his prescription there. It is medical marijuana. It was something that worked for him, and during the Sochi Olympics as well as the FIFA World Cup, that was permitted in Russia. So I think he was hopefully thinking that he qualified, wishful thinking perhaps, and that was his error.
How is Mark? Do you get to speak to him?
I do speak with him fairly regularly. It's been a very difficult fall. There was a large fire at the penal colony where he is living. So the overcrowded situation was then made more so. You know, for someone who can't run away from things or put yourself in that position, if you thought that fires were a real possibility and you were not very mobile and it's just freezing there, it's a very icy, slippery, dark situation.
And how is his health? Presumably his back problems as bad as ever or worse?
Oh, they're not getting any better. They've assured us now with the designation that he'll have a full medical evaluation as soon as he's home, but that doesn't help him now.
How did you feel when he missed out on previous prisoner swaps? And are you hoping he'll be in the next one?
Absolutely. We're well, it's gut-wrenching, especially for my mother, who will be 96 years old in March. Doesn't really matter how old your kid is. They're still your kid. And it's not a good way to be exiting the planet.
What do you think of the political game that is being played, in which Mark is undoubtedly a pawn?
You know, my mother met with Donald Trump on the day that he was shot, actually. She was meant to be on stage with him to talk about Mark, and she did get a commitment from him that he would do everything in his power to have him released. He is absolutely a political pawn, which is, I think, really why he was designated. A little late, but we're still happy for it. It's very strange when global politics enter your life in a very personal way. It's otherworldly.
That was Anne Fogel, sister of Mark Fogel, currently detained in Russia on charges of drug smuggling. And he's recently been redesignated or classified as wrongly detained. He was speaking to my colleague Paul Hendy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. These are febrile times in the United States ahead of the inauguration of Donald Trump as the media takes stock of the changing political climate. And a cartoonist at the Washington Post has resigned after the newspaper refused to publish a satirical cartoon of the paper's owner, Jeff Bezos, and other tycoons kneeling before a statue of the president-elect. The cartoonist, Anne Telness, described the refusal as dangerous for a free press. But David Shipley, the editorial page editor of the paper, said he decided not to run the cartoon in order to avoid repetition, not because it mocked the paper's owner. Well, Benjamin Mullin is media reporter at the New York Times, who's been following the story. And he began by describing to me the cartoon in detail.
It's a cartoon of Sam Altman, the founder of OpenAI, Patrick Soon-Shiong, the owner of the Los Angeles Times, Meta founder Mark Zuckerberg, and Amazon chief executive and Washington Post owner Jeffrey Bezos.
And what are they doing?
They are genuflecting toward a vestige of Donald Trump.
Along with Mickey Mouse.
That's right. Mickey Mouse, you can't even see his face, is bowing in front of the statue also.
And the implication, obviously, is that all these individuals are beholden or could become beholden to the president-elect.
That's right. A lot of rich individuals have visited Mar-a-Lago, which is President Trump's club in, I think, southwestern Florida. And a lot of billionaires, founders of companies, have donated to President Trump's inaugural celebration. And so the idea, I think, behind the cartoon is to show that there are people who are trying to curry favor with Trump before he takes office.
Is that the case, would you imagine, in terms of the media landscape in the United States, that a lot of media companies are having a bit of a rethink?
Well, yes. I mean, I do think you've seen certain companies, tech and media firms, take steps to sort of tout their independence or their commitment to covering the Trump administration fairly. You saw, I think, Meta replaced Nick Clegg, who is their well-known public affairs executive, with somebody who I think has ties to the conservative party. And many media owners have taken pains to, I think, sort of signal their independence. Patrick Soon-Shiong, the owner of the LA Times in particular.
The cartoonist has called the newspaper's decision to kill her cartoon a game changer that she says was dangerous for a free press. Will other journalists have similar shivers?
Well, I've seen a lot of mail in my inbox post that story running from readers who said that they abandoned their subscriptions to the Washington Post because of this kind of thing. As far as journalists go, I think a lot of journalists have already left the Washington Post, but I think that might have more to do with where they see the business and the management going than any kind of political affiliation.
David Shipley, the Post's opinions editor, said that the cartoon was rejected because it was repetitive and not for political reasons. Is there any substance to that? I mean, have there been similar cartoons before in the Post?
His argument was they had a column by Eugene Robinson making a similar point, not a cartoon, but a column. Alexandra Petrie, who's a humor columnist for The Washington Post, I think had pitched a column with a similar thrust. And so his argument was, we don't want to have a double standard. We didn't do similar cartoons before the Biden inaugural, and we've already had people make this point in our pages.
Because The Washington Post refused to endorse Kamala Harris back in November, which angered many of its own journalists. One columnist, in fact, said that decision was a stab in the back, and the former Republican Liz Cheney said it was a disgrace. A difficult question, I think, to answer, but is the Washington Post increasingly kowtowing to the interests of Mr. Bezos, its owner?
Well, Jeff Bezos has told people that I've spoken with that he thinks the Washington Post needs to make more of an effort to appeal to middle America, sort of blue-collar workers. He wants it to be sort of America's newspaper and not a newspaper for the coastal elites. I have covered the Washington Post aggressively for years. I have yet to see examples that the newspaper has slanted its news coverage to favor Jeff Bezos's commercial interests.
His commercial interests, but what about his political instincts?
That's a good question. I mean, I imagine his political positioning is somewhat intertwined with his commercial interests outside of the Washington Post. The decision to spike the Kamala Harris editorial, I think even he would say the timing of that was ill-advised. If he was going to make a decision not to endorse, the time to do it was not right before the presidential election. That's for sure.
That was Benjamin Mullen, media reporter at the New York Times newspaper. And that's it. From this edition of NewsHour, from me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohammed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.